Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the Muslim Philanthropy Podcast. My name is Muhi Khwaja at American Muslim Community Foundation. And today we have on special guest Marguerite Hill, who is the founder and executive director at the Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative. Thank you so much for being on the show, Marguerite, and welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to connect with AMCF. So great work, and I love having these conversations.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, our listeners should be familiar with your work as you were nominated and received the Nonprofit Award for our Muslim Philanthropy Awards last year. So Muslim ARC has had definitely a busy year in 2020. And it was recognized by CARE and a few other organizations as well nationally. So congratulations on all of the hard work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's definitely a blessing and an honor to be of service. And, you know, we're deeply humbled by the honors and accolades we received last year. And we hope to live up to the high regard the community has for our work.
So, you know, we're here chatting because of Black History Month and because just bringing you back on to share more about Muslim ARC in full. I wanted to start out by just, you know, wanting to ask you about Black History Month and what it means to you personally.
Thank you. Well, Black History Month has been transformational for me growing up. So I was just reviewing something I wrote, a reflection. And sometimes, you know, when you get my age, it's like you kind of have to like kind of dig deep to remember, like, well, when was the first time I really had a Black History Month program? And when were some of the shifts even in the Muslim community? Because I've been Muslim for almost three decades now. And sure. Seeing some of the writings and, you know, like when I was a child in the 80s. So, you know, there was a time in my childhood, even Martin Luther King Day wasn't, you know, a holiday, right? And Black History Month, the way that it was taught, you know, maybe during February, a teacher in elementary school would kind of like raise the question around, you know, or bring up slavery. And that was like my first introduction. And I wrote about that experience, right, of being asked, did I have ancestors that were slaves? And that was the only thing I knew about my own history as a young African-American girl. And, but it was also that history, the way that I understood it, it carried a lot of shame. And when I eventually transferred, or we moved actually from Santa Clara, we lived in an immigrant neighborhood in Santa Clara, and we moved to East San Jose, and I had my first Black teachers. And that transformed how I saw my own history. And I think either it was in my freshman year or... but it was early on, we watched the documentary Eyes on the Prize. And that for me, the actual resistance against oppression, that for me, it sparked deep anger, but also pride that it wasn't something like our freedom or where we were at as Black people was just something that was handed to us. Like, you know, the narrative around Abraham Lincoln and when I was in elementary school, I remember there was like a little white girl and she had she actually started crying. She was angry. She started yelling. She said her great 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 grandfather died freeing my people. And that one, it's like it's very disempowering, right? It's just like, okay, like so they fought this war, like the Civil War, and there wasn't any accounts of Black Union fighters at the time. But later on, years in high school, one of my teachers, he took us on a field trip to see Glory. And that movie also sparked a pride in my own identity, the resistance that enslaved peoples had against their oppression. So that history within itself, it's caused a deep exploration of looking both at the civil rights movements of union fighters. And then in 93, the Malcolm X movie came out. So sure. Even within popular culture, the ways that my teachers talked about history. And so I had a social studies teacher named Mr. Smith, and he made all of us memorize all of the countries in Africa. That was part of the exam, right? And he was a very hard teacher. He taught us how to outline. We had to be really in depth. We had to really study hard for his exams. And it was really Mr. Smith that sparked a passion for history. And he passed away suddenly in my junior year, and I actually received a scholarship on his behalf. It was a scholarship that helped me. It was like meant to apply for colleges. And even that little spark in history, years later, when I transferred from community college to undergrad at Santa Clara University, I wanted to become a social studies teacher. And it just came, that passion for history continues. And so Black history for me, as not only a catalyst in my identity formation as someone that had internalized so much anti-Blackness, became this month of looking at the achievements and contributions of African Americans. And eventually that spread further, right, to transnational, to broader, you know, to that deeper history and contributions, and eventually sparked an interest in Islam. So, you know, I mean, it's deeply connected even to my own religious identity formation as I eventually embraced Islam in 1993, partly due to that history of reclaiming the history of my own ancestors. Many of them had been come from Muslim majority regions that I would come to find. Like when you do the genealogy, and sure, people could say it's problematic, but, you know, we know 10 to 20% of enslaved Africans, many of them were Muslim. And so tapping into that history that was stolen from us was something that helped me expand beyond the box of that white supremacy put me in. And so that within itself, like I cannot disconnect Black History Month from my identity formation. Similarly, the history of Black people, right, in Islamic history is so deeply tied.
Agreed. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that insight and background in terms of what Black History Month means to you. I know growing up, I really didn't have much of a critical lens until maybe high school. And when I took AP US History or AP US Government and read Howard Zinn and, you know, People's History of the United States, and kind of like just that first chapter that Zinn writes on in terms of, you know, indigenous people here in America and everything like that, it just really lifted a veil from everything I was taught in public school, right? And I think that, you know, definitely have had influential professors when I was at college, and took a lot of African-American and African studies courses because I was a history major, so was able to learn and get a lot of new perspective throughout that experience. So, you know, in terms of Black History Month, AMCF is doing another initiative. Muslim Arc is one of 9 charities that we'll be representing and sharing more about through the podcast, through social media, through everything like that. So we're looking forward to the rest of the month of February as well. I wanted, you know, I know you shared a little bit about, you know, growing up and going to school and everything in between. If you want to fill in some of the gaps in terms of, you know, other family experiences or, you know, beyond school, how you got to Muslim Arc, whatever you'd like to share.
Yeah, well, I mean, as many of you know that I embraced Islam, right, like in 93. So, you know, like I grew up in a kind of in a majority Christian family, right? I mean, I was always like kind of like a religious searcher, like always seeking faith. And so having that understanding right? Like that background of as history as a Christian embracing Islam. And so those encounters were, you know, that is part of like who I am, right? Of like connecting across difference. And, you know, my family, having a multiracial family, being deeply familiar with the ways that white Americans, how they saw Black history and the types of conversations that would happen at dinner time or through the day. And so, you know, it's like, I know that there's many well-meaning people that the ways that they understand Black history or American history could be distorted. And so as a young Muslim who sought to discover my own identity, I eventually studied that in undergrad through, and also I did a lot of my own readings, because what I found that my colleges, like they weren't well informed about African history or Black history. And sometimes the ways that it was taught reified Black inferiority. And that differed from the types of work that I saw, like the types of studies that I saw in Ta'lim. So I embraced Islam from, I was influenced by family friends that were Black Muslims. So the first Muslims that I knew were all Black. And it was like part of like just really embracing that part of myself. And then when I went to community college, I had encounters with Muslims of all backgrounds. So the first people that taught me how to pray were two Filipino Muslim sisters. And I had different encounters. And part of what, you know, being a young college student from a working class background, I knew a lot of my co-religionists, they didn't have that, the history of Black people in America. You know, like they understood, some of them knew their own history. So I learned more about their cultures, issues of social issues that were of their concern. But for many years, like the issues that that I faced as African American or people that looked like me in inner cities, those weren't on the front and center of the Muslim student associations. And sure. So that kind of formed some of my identity or some of the issues that came to inform why we started Muslim ARC. So fast forward many, 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 many years later, right? So it's like we're talking like, you know, from 1994 to 2014, it's like the many decades of being Muslim, teaching in Muslim schools, and how not only the history is taught, but how we were relating to each other, how sometimes the contributions of Black Muslims were just limited to the story of Bilal, right? Or maybe, you know, you would get the story of the first Hijra to Ethiopia, right? And then it just stopped there as far as like, who were some of the Black Sahabi? What were some of the empires or interconnections in trade? And so when I started graduate school, I was admitted into both like Middle East and Islamic studies, and I focused on Islamic Africa. So that formed a lot of my research, was on the connectedness, the networks that connected North Africa to places like in the Sahel, which is like Northern Nigeria or Senegal, or, you know, people that were in motion. And I found that that history was also less known than, you know, and what was considered mainstream, which is usually like focusing on like the Middle East and less so on like Southeast Asia. So in 2014, when I saw still the kind of marginalization of Black narratives within Islam, so globally, right? Like if there was like a Ramadan program, right? Or like a news coverage around like, oh, you know, Eid al-Fitr around the world. And you would see, you know, lots of pictures from the Middle East, maybe Cairo, you would see pictures from Iran, you'd see maybe some pictures from Pakistan, but nothing from Senegal, you know, nothing from Nigeria. And Nigeria is like one of the most populous Muslim countries. Similarly, if there were like stories on, you know, BuzzFeed at the time, and they were like top 10 pictures of aid. And even though some of the, you know, what trended on social media, you would see Black Muslims, you know, like some of their pictures or posts would trend, mm-hmm. but the media coverage would completely ignore them and focus on South Asian or Middle Eastern Muslims. And so part of the reason why Muslim ARC started, we launched during Black History, because we wanted to address the erasure of Black Muslims in media and the types of things that were being lifted up in our own narratives. And we also wanted to address anti-Blackness. So we launched on February 12th with the hashtag being Black and Muslim. And what the intention was to invite Black Muslims globally to share their stories. So we had several prompts. I remember we were prepping the week before. We're like, on this date, we're going to have this conversation. So share your stories. And we had prompts, and we asked those who came from different backgrounds, like, please be polite, don't derail the conversation. And so what we found was that there was a lot of amazing just stories of pride. People shared their favorite, like their cuisine, what it meant to be Black and Muslim, historical figures that they were proud of. But there was also some of the heartbreak, and it just kind of sparked this deep conversation. Muslim ARC didn't start conversations around what it meant, you know, what it means to be Black Muslims. But what we did do was like help elevate and sustain that conversation. What our hope was that, because what we found was like every few years, there was like these kind of intense national conversations during conferences around racism, but they weren't sustained. So they would kind of go away, and then the issue would come back up every, you know, a few years later. Well, we saw that it was absolutely pressing and incumbent upon us to address it. And so that we wouldn't lose another generation to people being disillusioned, to anti-Blackness, to people feeling marginalized, or that their own history, right, is not being honored within the American Muslim Ummah in particular, but also globally.
And I think a few interesting points that you make around, erasure and just that experience. I'm familiar with the Black Iftar that, and you also mentioned like the MSAs, right? And the whole structure and just integration even, or representation. So can you share a little bit more on like the Black Iftar? And then even if you want to go into like the Black Muslim COVID-19 coalition and stuff like that, in terms of why it's important for, again, like the Black Muslim community to have these experiences as well.
Yeah. So, there's another sister that founded Black Iftar, and, and it's not without controversy. I mean, that sister has received a number of really horrible posts, some threats, some takfir, like people denied her Islam. And part of what she was trying to do was really to create a space that was safe for Black Muslims and allies to come together, but one that centered our cultural experience. So for example, in Los Angeles, this is when we were able to gather, right? There's a Bangladeshi iftar, right? Growing up, like there would be like a Libyan American iftar, maybe you'd get an invite, maybe not. Like if you're an outsider, usually not. But you know, like there was like the Syrian American iftar. And so culturally different groups were, you know, like, or the Pakistani Doctors Association iftar. So the ethnic groups could be named previously, but it was like, there's something that was like deeply triggering for this idea that there's like that Black people have a shared cultural experience, and that we wanted people to honor that and to join us, and maybe even like if in some of our masajid or some of the places we would like to share cuisine and which is less known, you know, like it's not as common outside of Black Muslim communities. And what we know is like there's studies that have shown that that while African Americans are much more likely to go to masajid of different backgrounds, right? Like we'll be in a predominantly South Asian masjid and it's sure. we'll be in a predominantly Arab masjid. You know, and some of the other ethnic groups, maybe a little bit less so depending on the denomination or sect that one's in, but very like it's less likely that people of different backgrounds are going to come to a predominantly African-American masjid. And some of that has to do with bias around inner city, right? Or just like, oh, I don't have a need to go. Like, it's like I'm, you know, and an aversion to being, some people feel an aversion to be in communities where not everybody's like them, right? Because we, like, as people sure. of color, marginalized in this society, we tend to want to be around our affinity group because we're like, yeah, you know, it's already enough to be an outsider. So some people may be like, you know what, like, why should I go to Harlem or Oakland or South Central LA and go to this iftar when I'm just right, you know, like if you're in the Los Angeles area where I'm comfortable in Orange County where there's 2% Black people and I'm never going to have like a predominantly Black experience. And so, I think what Black Iftar allows, like kind of a third space for those who come from, especially if you're coming outside of like a predominantly Black community where they exist. And so it just allows people to be able to connect across the diaspora, because Black people are very diverse. Like there's Afro-Latino, continental, coming from different countries, Nigeria, Senegal, Gambia, Guinea, Ethiopia, Somalia, you know? So it's like, sometimes there's just a need for us to talk about what does it mean to be Black? And, you know, and Afro, we have Afro-Caribbean, and even regionally, we have different things, like how we eat different, like different foods that we eat. And so, you know, it's just been such a great experience to witness Black Iftar pickup. The one that I attended, it was organized by Nia Malika Dixon, and there were people of all backgrounds that joined in the iftar, and we had Senegalese food, and so to be able to share and to be like, this is what my culture offers, that's something that we want to be able to share in, like, what is Black culture within Muslim spaces. And I think if people kind of, you know, tap into that and say, like, you know, like, you know, like, that's the part of us getting to know one another. So the, I think with the second part of your question was both like, was it just around the Black Iftar, but there's another part I feel like I'm missing.
Yeah. On the Black Muslim COVID Coalition.
Yeah, so the Black Muslim COVID Coalition, the formation of that, it started with conversations, and I know the conversation started a little bit before I was pulled in, but I remember being in a convening with within a kind of predominantly Muslim space, but it's also had people from like South Asian and Middle East and Muslims of all backgrounds. But in this conversation, there was only two Black Muslims. And, you know, and I just remembered, it was like during this early days of the pandemic, the kinds of questions, like it was, you know, and it, I mean, I'm just kind of pulled back into that moment where I didn't know what was going to happen, right? And all I knew was like the whole country was shutting down. And, you know, and when Dr. Camila Mutman Rashad, you know, reached out to me and was just like, well, what do you need, right? What do we need to do as a people? And she had brought up, she brought up a text called The Psychology of Pandemics. And so with that framework, so from that conversation, so, you know, we realized that, and this is before we knew any of the statistics, we're like, it's likely going to hit the Black community so much harder than anything, you know, that we could imagine, right? That we would know. Because at that time, we didn't even know if Black people could get it. Like, we were just like, we don't know what's going to happen, but the country's mm-hmm. shut down. The economics of this is going to be bad on us. But, you know, and as we started to see more and more people get it, you know, so it was like, it went from jokes to like, oh my gosh, like this is really, really serious and it's going to affect our jobs. We're much more likely to get it and we're probably going to die at higher rates. And so we also had a lot of denial and conspiracy theories around it. So we gathered, about 40 community leaders, youth leaders, like people working in all sorts of areas across the country to begin information campaigns to address the different dimensions of the pandemic from a trauma. And we wanted to address, like, recognize the trauma with the medical industry, given the history of medical experimentations, but also, you know, just for many years, every year there's a pandemic following the civil war, and that Black people died at just really astronomical rates. And so we created those education campaigns because we knew we needed to have cultural brokers of people who look like us, but doctors that they could trust, right? Needed to collect the stories of our elders. So that's why we had the wisdom of our elders, because it was hitting elders at stark rates. And so, you know, it was really a place of connecting across community during a time when everything was shutting down. People were feeling very isolated, extremely stressed. And, and we needed a place to discuss, bringing together experts to talk about the long-term impact of the pandemic. We knew it was going to be a long road, you know, like it was just, I mean, I still hard to believe, like it was like, we're here, it's like almost a year later. Last year, this time, we were just getting news stories about this virus, deadly virus in the Wuhan province. I saw like there were some Muslims that were saying really racist things about Asians. And we were fighting against that. But little did I know at the time that it would come and just, you know, decimate not only my organization, because my organization was impacted, my co-founder contracted it, and she's, you know, and she eventually, like, she was out for 6 weeks. She couldn't work for 6 weeks. And then because of health reasons, she did resign. So we lost like half our staff. Then it was like we had some contractors, we lost that. I mean, donations, like everything was just, we were so decimated. But I felt the need, like there is such an importance that we had to lean into that role, even though we didn't have funding, even though we were just like, as an organization, when I look back at this time last year, and I was, you know, thinking like, we were almost not here, but it was just the passion and the drive of me and a few people, and really the Black Muslim COVID Coalition and Dr. Camila Mutman Rashad is really, you know, bolstered me to keep that together and to step forward into the leadership to address those disproportionate rates of Black mortality. And even now, I mean, there's members of our coalition that have, you know, like, Angelica Lindsay, Village Auntie, she just contracted COVID. Wow, so it's like so many of our friends, we're seeing still so many people pass from COVID and, you know, and our recovery. So we still have a long road to go through this. And this is why we still have to support Muslim Wellness Foundation and Muslim Arc so that we can get the capacity to support not only those who are dealing with COVID, right? And the isolation of COVID, those who contracted, like sometimes we would gather money up and send care packages because we had members That's who sweet. Couldn't breathe,
yeah.
Family members. Like we were like, can we get you, you know, some steam device to help you breathe, right? Some, you know, food, even like people couldn't work. And so the mutual aid work is still necessary. It's still going on. And both of, you know, I know for Muslim Arc, we had to kind of pivot, right, after the murder of George Floyd, because then there was like this demand for anti-racism work and every Black person working in diversity, equity, inclusion, we were hit up to do work and to educate and to train. And so that of going from the complete collapse, you know, like disintegration of an organization to build up new leadership during such a short time, like it's still, I mean, I think I sometimes deal with sometimes the vicarious, like the, not even the vicarious, just the trauma of just like, I as a single parent homeschooling my child, like so many other mothers during a time of like, where there's just so many unknowns and just knowing I wasn't alone and that it was incumbent upon us to have mm-hmm. a racial justice framework so that we could center those who are most impacted and do the most good. And so we still have a long road to go, but I mean, it's just been so encouraging to be able to connect across difference and to build a multiracial and multi-faith team with Muslim ARC to address these issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody uses the word resiliency, but I don't know like what other way to put it. And, you know, it's really phenomenal to see the work and the trainings and everything else that the team has done. We definitely want to have Dr. Rashad and Muslim Wellness Foundation on the podcast. They're one of the other 9 organizations that we're highlighting this month as well. If you can, you know, whether you want to do like the elevator pitch or just like the overarching, what are some of the other programs that Muslim ARC has? I know you guys have the UML and a few other things. So if you want to go into depth on that.
Yeah, so the American Muslim Anti-Racism Leadership Program, the UML program, is probably our most important program for 2021. And this is a fellowship program where we do need your support in building a new leadership pipeline. We're raising funds to support 10 leaders who would get anti-racism training over a 9-month period. So we'd go through a curriculum and discussions and projects to deepen Muslim ARC's work. And with our goal is that with those 10 leaders, that we can expand Muslim ARC's work throughout the country, right? And that they can continue on. You know, it's like, I mean, we always have to think about how do we lift up new emerging leaders? And as now, you know, like I'm at auntie status, it's like finding young leaders, being intergenerational is absolutely mm-hmm. important. So we're working to identify, applications are still open for that. So please do visit our website and our social media channels to get those announcements. But we do need your support in investing in those 10 leaders because it's a lot of work to do anti-racism, to learn it. And what we plan is to come together so that we can be our best, that we could build solidarity. And investing in them is going to ensure the future for Muslim ARC.
That's really great. You know, I think we definitely covered a lot. Is there anything else that you still want to talk about or share and include on Muslim ARC and other things that you have going on?
Yeah, so Muslim ARC, we are a membership-based organization. And so a lot of our programming, so this Saturday, we do have a program with Ustaz Ubaydullah Evans. Every month we do have membership meetings. We have, we are volunteer driven and we really work on building out curriculum for our members, but also for the public. So be on the lookout and do take our workshops, bring us out, but we'll also work to host numerous anti-racism trainings. It's absolutely important that we learn how to talk about race within our communities, that we be able to talk about solidarity and build authentic relationships so that we can strengthen our network and strengthen our ummah.
That's great. And I also saw you guys are doing like office hours type of thing with tea with Marguerite. So how's that been going?
It's been really great. It helps connect, right? Like there's a lot of people, like they don't know exactly what Muslim ARC does or how they could get involved, but I'm also learning so much from community, right? And when they have questions and concerns, they could come, you know, show up during those office hours. And it just really helps me stay connected. And it's not just during one-off events, right? It's really like, here's a time where we can connect and get to know one another and have tea. I know there's like a tea shortage because everybody's drinking tea with COVID because like we're all home and trying to, you know, relax and calm down. And but you know, like, it's like tea is kind of part of so many Muslim cultures. And so it's really nice to be able to slow down a little bit and just take some time to get to know people. So I'm available for tea time if you want to drop in with questions, if you want to chat, if you have any concerns, right? You could connect. Usually the RSVP is on our social media channels. And that's on Tuesdays at 12 p.m. Eastern.
Great. Marguerite, like, you know, I think your leadership in the community is fantastic, and everybody needs to learn more about Muslim ARC and your work. I'm really grateful to have an opportunity to have gotten to know you over the last few months and through the last year, and have you at the annual symposium and on the podcast. You know, anything else that I can do to help you and your work, I'm going to do everything that I can to try. And I think that everybody else should learn about Muslim ARC as well.
Well, Jazakallah khair for all of your support. It means so much to us. Like, AMCF has really helped us, help sustain us during the most difficult times. So thank you. We're truly grateful, and we're happy to be in a partnership with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much.